Nehemiah chapter 3. You remember that in answer to the challenge of Nehemiah's local enemies, those in the far side of the Euphrates, their challenge that he was rebelling against the king, Nehemiah answered thus, never mentioning the king. At that moment, the king was far from his thoughts. When they said he was rebelling against the king, he said, the God of heaven will give us success. The God of heaven was someone they knew little about. Their God resided in another place than in heaven, having been tuffed out of it. And Nehemiah went on, we, his servants, will start rebuilding. But as for you, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right to it. And that put them in their place for the time. We therefore go on to see how determinedly Nehemiah and all who were with him addressed themselves to this colossal task of rebuilding the ruined walls and setting up the gates of Jerusalem. The beginning of the chapter is quite as astonishing as anything you could read in the Holy Scriptures, especially the Old Testament, namely, a high priest of Israel with something like a trowel in his hand. It's even more rich than seeing a bishop, as I heard of Bishop Hugh Gough, formerly of Barking and then of Australia, dressed in all the finery of his vestments, with an ordinary shepherd's crook in his hand, not a bejeweled and golden one. For you see, it was no less than the high priest himself and his fellow priests who were rebuilding the sheep gate. Now, the map you have been given is one of several reconstructions very different from one another and all somewhat speculative. I chose this one because it was clear, whereas the one in Derek Kidner's commentary may be nearer the mark in some places, but would not have copied well and looks rather curious, with the southern part of Jerusalem very elongated, and indeed unlike what I imagine it from my visit there in 1965. You will note that while Nehemiah, on his night reconnaissance, started out from the valley gate, somewhere around the southwest of the city, the first record of actual rebuilding is of the priests commencing their part of it at almost the opposite end and side of the city, the northeast, at the sheep gate. And according to this map, you can see how convenient the sheep gate was for those coming from the north, driving their flock into the city toward the temple precincts, with the nearby pool of Bethesda, in which Ellicott says the sheep were washed before being brought to the temple for sacrifice. Isn't it great to visualize these prelates of the temple, discarding or gathering up their priestly garments and getting down in unaccustomed fashion to some hard manual work. And I thought, what about some of us asking the successful contractor for the spire for a job? Anyway, we see from our map the portion of the wall they rebuilt, and the fact that having done their job to their satisfaction, these priests were immediately dedicated their work to God. And this indicated that they had not abandoned their priestly function to engage in other manual work, but could switch from one to the other without bother. And that's great. And it's interesting, you know, suggesting, does it not, the priestliness of ordinary labor, especially for those, of course, within the priesthood of all believers. One of the artificial snobberies of modern days is to regard manual labor as belonging to a lower order than mental work. Where do we get these notions from? The first work undertaken by man was gardening. And even the highest in the land love gardening. King George VI used to love nothing so much as pruning bushes and hauling cut down trees and bushes about his grounds. And even his widow, the Queen Mother, in her 90s, may still like to cast a line from her fishing rod on the river. The adjoining section of the wall, moving westwards, anti-clockwise, verse 2, was built by the men of Jericho. Whether these were Jews who had remained in Jericho during the captivity or who had returned from Babylon to their former homes and had come all the way from the Jordan Valley to take part in the work. Either way, we have an indication of the nature of Jewish loyalty, typical of those bound together by the commands and the covenants of Jehovah. Whether Zachor, son of Imri, was a single individual working on his own next to the Jerichoites, or whether this represents his family, is not said. We then come, verse 3, to the fish gate, through which fish from Galilee and possibly from Jordan were brought to market. We'll read more about that in the last chapter of Nehemiah, chapter 13. That was rebuilt by the sons of Hasenaah, and Kidner thinks Senaha is a place, although there is a person of that name in chapter 11, verse 9. They seem to have been very practical men and knew about bolts and beams and bars of doors. And from that point onwards, our map shows a zigzag line to the broad wall, with a number of men working in that section. Verse 4, Meremoth is interesting, since the same Meremoth received the gold and silver and precious vessels when they were weighed on Ezra's return to Jerusalem. 13 years before, we read of him in Ezra 8 and 33. Meshulam, was next to him, and Zadok next to him. And at verse 5, the men of Tekoa, Amos's hometown, far to the south, were working. But their nobles were too proud to be workmen under supervisors. And the priests, including the high priest, would have taught them a lesson in humility. But that didn't stop the men of Tekoa repairing another section, as verse 27 says, east of the city on Ophel. We'll come to that. That takes us down at verse 6 to the Jeshana, or old, or corner gate, as on our map. Its beams, etc., put in place by Joiada and another Meshulam. And next to them, men came from Gibeon and Mizpah, a few miles north of the city. And if the translation of verse 7 is right, these came from beyond the boundary of Judah, which would not have been easy for them to do, since they were under the jurisdiction of the provincial governor, who was against the whole proceeding. All the more credit to them for daring to come. Next to them at verse 8, who do you think is working at repairing stone walls but one of the goldsmiths? And one of the perfumers. All honor to men normally engaged in exceedingly refined work, working in parlor situations, for being willing to change their jobs and dirty their hands. It was, in fact, all hands of the community on deck. That brought them to the broad wall, which is plain on our map. And beyond it, verse 9, a ruler of what may have been a suburb of Jerusalem was at work. Thence, at verse 10, to a section repaired by a man near his own house, with another man, Hattush, next to him. Malchiah, at verse 11, is interesting because he appears as one who had been guilty of intermarriage. You remember we read of that in Ezra chapter 10, and he appears at verse 31 there. Change in his heart and lifestyle indeed. These men must have covered a fair section, taking the work past the Ephraim gate, which is not mentioned in our text, but is referred to in 2 Kings 14:13, along with the corner gate, concerning, I've spoken of this on Saturday, studying the Psalms, the corner gate, concerning the audacious capture of King Amaziah of Judah by Jehoash, the northern king. I say, taking the work past the Ephraim gate to the tower of ovens or furnaces, which is taking us far down the west side, the left-hand west side of the city, the left-hand side of the map. Then here's another ruler of a Jerusalem district. We might say, perhaps, a town or county councillor at work. And who do you think, at verse 12, helping him, but his daughters? Good for these lassies. How far they worked, it doesn't say. But in our map, the distance from the Tower of Ovens to the Valley Gate, where, you remember, Nehemiah started his nocturnal tour of inspection and round the sharp corner eastwards, that's quite a way, you see. And the valley gate itself, verse 13, was repaired by Hanum and the residents from Zanoah, which was southwest of the city, almost as far as the Philistine territory. See how far they came. And these men from Zanoah also repaired 500 yards of the south wall to the dung gate, which of course led to the refuse tip called Gehenna, the place of incineration of the city's rubbish, which, as you know, gives its name in the New Testament to hell. Gehenna, hell, as distinct from Hades, the abode of the dead. Gehenna is the place of everlasting burning. You know, this idea of setting fire to the rubbish dump could give some cleansing departments ideas. Not only to consume the rubbish, but to deal with vermin. The dung gate itself, verse 14, was repaired and set up by another Malchijah, ruler of Beth-Hakkerem. Beth-Hakkerem means vineyard house. And according to Jeremiah 6 and 1, it was as far south as Tekoa, or even further south. And with that, verse 15, we are round the southeast corner, and now heading north to the fountain gate. This is not so easy. With the king's pool adjacent, and the pool of Siloam a little further on. The fountain gate was repaired and set up by Shallum, ruler of Mizpah, which of course is north of the city, pretty near the border of Judah, where he might have had to reckon again with the hostile governor and his staff. Nonetheless, he repaired the wall of what was really, I think, the pool of Shelah, not Siloam, by the king's garden, where the steps led down from David's city. Now to verse 16, next to Shallum, another Nehemiah wrought, a ruler of the half district of Beth-Zar, which is a place even further south than Tekoa, well on the way to Hebron. He worked to a point opposite what are called David's sepulchres, although the traditional site of David's tomb is much further west, as those who have been there know. This other Nehemiah worked as far as the artificial pool, which may be another name for the king's pool. Beyond that, at verse 17, the repairs were carried out by a batch of Levites, with both the rulers, along with the rulers of the two half districts of Keilah. Keilah is south of Adullam. And beside them, verse 18, next to them, verse 19, another ruler from Mizpah wrought. And beyond that, where we suppose Nehemiah, in his nocturnal tour of inspection, had to dismount, because you remember of the steepness of the ground and the rubble, we find Baruch, verse 20, particularly zealous with repairs. And these repairs, according to our map, may well have been around that slight angle you see in the map opposite the word Ophel. See that? These repairs reached the entrance of the high priest's house. And next to him, Meremoth again, at verse 21, one of the first workers at the other side of the city, brought the repairs forward to the far side of the high priest's house, beyond which, verse 22, priests were still working. And beyond that again, verse 23, two certain men repaired opposite their own dwelling houses, until another man, Binui, verse 24, reached what I take from our map to be the sharp angle where the two walls, the outer and the inner, meet. Now, look at this point. This is still the most dramatic part of the city. Not many will not have seen photographs of this sharp corner and the great gorge underneath it, because of the sheer drop, the sheer declivity, tumbling down into the gorge of the valley of Kidron. In our Lord's day, this point was sometimes called the pinnacle or wing of the temple, from which the devil, you remember, wanted Jesus to hurl himself down, and God's angels would save him. But if he had been enough to obey Satan, they wouldn't have been able to save him. As I say, this is the most dramatic point in the whole city to this day, either viewed from its height, looking down into the gorge of Kidron, or looking up from it to the present wall, with today, alas, on that high plateau behind the sharp point of the wall, on that high plateau, not as formerly the temple of the Jews, but the mosque of Omar, over what is believed is Moriah, where Abraham and Isaac were. And you can descend a staircase within the Mosque of Omar to the supposed site of Abraham's attempted sacrifice of his son. And you would have seen in the paraphrase the reference to that, which was intriguing. And alongside it, at that corner, alongside that plateau, not only the Mosque of Omar, the second most sacred shrine of the Muslims, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, a smaller mosque. And you can tell from verse 25 that this was not an easy area to work in, with its steepness. Nor is it surprising that the temple servants were involved here, verse 26, to the water gate, which is the first, you see, of the series of gates as you see them on the map. The horse gate, the east gate, the prison gate, right up to the corner, turning back to where the building began at the sheep gate. Men from Tekoa were working there, as verse 27 says, with priests at the horse gate, as Zadok is repairing near his house, and Shemaiah, who guarded the east gate, whatever that means, made repairs there, with others, Hananiah and Hanan, repairing. Others, verse 30, next to them, Meshulam again, and Malchijah, verse 31, one of the goldsmiths, is working in another place. So men had moved from one side of the city to the other. When they'd completed one part, they went and worked in another. The inspection gate might well be the prison gate of our map. And so, turning the corner and returning with the help of the goldsmiths and the merchants to the sheep gate, we are back again at where the rebuilding started. Now, there is much, of course, about all this that we are uncertain of, and much about which scholars and working archaeologists have pontificated. With Kathleen Kenyon, the daughter of Sir Frederick Kenyon, the former famous curator of the British Museum and a great Christian, she has said some very pertinent things about archaeology and digging in Jerusalem. I heard Kathleen Kenyon lecture in Edinburgh after speaking at a CU meeting some years ago, and she certainly had done a great deal of digging and research, as indeed the former Professor Alexander Gray of the Old Testament Chair at King's College, Christ College Divinity, had done a great deal. That reminded me of something that Tom Swanson said about Professor Gray. And the professor has written a book on all this and the kings. Tom Swanson used to say to Professor Gray, "Dr. Gray, you've left me nothing to preach about in many of these psalms. And all that the dear scholar man," and he was a kindly soul, "would say, is that so, Tom?" Which wasn't much help. I suppose he thought it was perhaps all beyond Tom. But then, you see, it was Tom who had to minister the word, and he needed to know what was what, not what modern or even ancient theories had spifflicated the substance out of the text. But the value of our chapter, you see, is not the act accuracy of our specifications as to the repairs and the repairers, but the determination of Nehemiah, which we fully looked into in chapter 2, to see ruined Jerusalem fit to lift up its head again before its detractors. And the result, you see, we begin to see now in how Nehemiah galvanized so many of every sort into purposive and fruitful action. If you take the chapter and see the different sorts of characters who engaged in this work, from the high priest and his fellow priest and the Levites and the temple servants to a man's daughters and goldsmiths and perfumers and merchants and rulers of various kinds, and then with the text and with a good general map of the whole area, see the directions whence these people came to repair the wall and set up their gates. From the north, from Mizpah, Gibeon, and Meroneth, north of Gibeon, from the east, in the Jordan Valley, Jericho, from the south, Zanoah, Beth Hakkerem, Beth Zur, Keilah, Tekoa. You see what a richly cooperative and practically communal, if not nearly national, effort this was that these people engaged in. And when you read Nehemiah chapter 4, verse 6, and Nehemiah's immediate conclusion when the wall reached half its height, because the people, he said, worked with all their heart. You see what can be accomplished by a heterogeneous crew when they are unified into a coordinate team and energized by a single predominant idea inspired by God and led by a man with crystal clear notions of what the Lord has said to him and who is utterly committed to what God has said. And that's all you need when a man, one man, has been mastered by the notion of what God proposes to be done, and when the Lord is with him to do a singular work against all odds. Bring all that up to date. Do you think this Billy Graham mission may be like that? I have not been involved in a major evangelistic endeavor since 1955. And there was a gap of nearly 10 years between that effort, when I was in charge of all the counseling on the field at Pittodrie, and the time at the beginning of this year when God told me that he required that I should be involved in this and invite our people to be involved in it too. But you see, in 1946, the Lord told me, after all the heated evangelism of that 18 months, 1945-46, God told me at the end of 1946 that evangelism was not to be my calling, but Bible teaching. Why, then, am I involved in it now, along with some of you? I don't know, except that it must be God that told us to become involved, although it has been a new departure for many of us. And since then, taking the word from God, I have done everything I thought I could to stir you all up, do every endeavor and play your part. Some have been magnificent, others fair, and others sadly and woodenly uncooperative. What is it going to achieve? I hope something special. I mean, not necessarily by the size of the statistic, although those involved in it are very much taken up with that, but by the depth and the width and the height of the impact it may make on Aberdeen and the surrounding area. It might be, you know, that the first night is so powerful that the whole town will soon know, and people flock to the other two meetings. Or it might not be like that at all. It could be that among those coming forward, there are one or two, it might be only one trophy of grace amongst all who doubtless will come forward. One trophy of grace, who is perhaps yet destined to move thousands and even communities and even our nation, or other nations, back to God and righteousness and sanity. The like has been known in Scotland before, with John Knox, Robert Moffat, young William Phillips' ancestor, David Livingstone, Thomas Chalmers. This is one of the things I hope we shall be praying for a week on Wednesday, instead of Bible study, when I want you all to be there to pray for the mission the night before it starts. We are to have our prayer meeting then, so as to leave everyone free to be at Pittodrie, if they will, on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. We might pray then, and we should be praying now, for significant trophies, and not to be taken up with the numbers and the statistics game. People are so taken up with that. Did I not say this morning, one of the first things that journalistic interviewers ask about a congregation is, how many members have you? Not what sort of members they are, which is much more important than the number, isn't it? What sort of members do you have? Would be a far better question, wouldn't it? I feel like saying, when they ask me that, you ask, how many members have we? Do you mean at home or abroad? For that is how publicity works in this modern world. Size. No, no, no. Get some notable sinners converted and let the world know, it will soon know, if the world sees the change in their lives. And let their testimony be noised abroad, and men will come to hear, as they did to hear and see the man who had shaken the woman of Samaria to the core, you remember. The crowds who came to hear John the Baptist, and Paul on Mars Hill, and many of the great ones of the gospel throughout the ages, such as Augustine. But back to the wall. What was Nehemiah doing while all that kaleidoscopic array of characters was busy building the walls and preparing and rearing the gates? What was he doing? He was inspiring them all. He had reconnoitered the situation in the clear, cool hush of the night, when men often hatch their best plans, don't they? Do you? I do. And he saw what was to be done. But he was inspired by his God, so that he was able to galvanize practically the whole community into concerted action and united endeavor, so that everyone played their part in their section of the wall or at their particular gate, and they worked like Trojans to build the wall right round the city. And many hands made light work, or lighter work. No one looked over his shoulder to see what his neighbor was doing. He concentrated on his own task. And as they all addressed themselves to their part of the work, it proceeded far more quickly than if periodic committee meetings with sundry conferences and discussions had taken place. Each person of each viewpoint giving their democratic opinion unto such complete confusion as so often reigns in the House of Commons with its shouting matches, and often nothing much more is done but a vast expenditure of hot air. Oh, a theocracy, not a democracy, a theocracy, ruled by God, is much more efficient. And it keeps to the point. And even when its priests have to roll up the sleeves and gird up the skirts and do a manual job, they don't forget that it is the Lord's work they are doing. So that when it is completed, it has to be dedicated. Everything has to be dedicated. All we do is, or ought to be, unto the Lord, however mundane it is. There can hardly be anything more mundane than building stones into a wall and rearing city gates. But since it is all in the interest of the Lord's people and the Lord's place and the Lord's work, the Lord's place where he is to dwell and bless his people, it has all to be dedicated. Mind you, that could be turned into an awful ritual and a bondage. Some people are bound by their ritual. For instance, a very pious lady was being given a cup of tea in a certain home. And when there was no sign that prayers were to be said over this simple cup of tea, she paused, bowed her head, and said her own silent prayer to the confusion of her host. Some of the godliest people I know. That, I think, is simply sanctimonious humbug. You don't need unnecessarily to obtrude your religion if it's real. That will soon show, and will show itself in your sweet humility and your unaffected love for God and his people. Some people's obtrusive piety. What is it Proverbs says about, be not over righteous? Ah, that's very penetrating. Some people's obtrusive piety. Like the Pharisees that stood at the corners of the streets to say their prayers in sight of the people. Some people's obtrusive piety is a pain in the neck. On the other hand, there is a secularity about even church life today, which is equally nauseating. I was looking at church news in that free local evening paper that is put through our letterboxes, whether we want it or not. And there was a whole list of church activities. And beyond mentioning the Pentecostal march that took place today, I read in a long list of church activities, a church auction sale, a church concert, two church jumble sales, these horrid, snobbish West End affairs, when East End folk are patronized by West End members getting rid of their unwanted junk for cash, raising funds for well-off churches from the pittances of the poor. I read of six church coffee mornings, a BB one, a green one, whatever that was, green coffee, a Presbyterial one, a Christian Aid one, an intestinal disorders one, an overseas one, a BB display of work, a Sunday meal arranged by the local church in the town hall for Iraq and Ethiopia, and last of all, one Sunday service to welcome new members. That's the church in Scotland and in Aberdeen today, with all their doors closed tonight. When I pass these two churches coming down the road on Sunday night, my heart is sore. Doors locked on the Lord's Day evening. There's a time and place for everything, as the Ecclesiastes writer says. But the time for living for the Lord, whether we are washing clothes or dealing with souls, the time for living for the Lord is always. And you know, we'll see more of this as this exciting book of Nehemiah unfolds. But the great thing is this: to be in tune with the Lord's overarching and overwhelming purposes, and to be busy doing the job he has assigned to us at each moment in time. Whether it is praying or patching walls, is all the same to him who sanctifies all for his everlasting purposes, in which his born again people are involved. Oh, let us not. This is a famous word these days in another connection. Don't let any of us opt out and see that we are engaged in the building the walls of that Jerusalem that the book of the Revelation speaks of, that is ever lasting. Amen.